Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app.
Welcome back to the weekly roundup on the dialogue with Dewa De Boer and William McGimsey for Reality Check Radio, where we take a retrospective on key events from the previous week. And this is going to be our final show for the year, the final weekly roundup, maybe a yearly roundup, because I think we might revisit a few threads that we have been following throughout the year. And in my case, something that's been going on for 5 years, but I will let William ask me some questions about that, and I'll try to explain the context of this situation, because it was a court case that I won last week after 5 years of battling with New Zealand police. So that's going to be our key item. That's definitely a highlight for me to end my year on. And then we'll get into William's highlights if we have some time for that. So welcome back to the show, William.
Thanks, Dewa. Good to be here.
Well, I guess I may as well start by explaining the court case that I won against New Zealand police, and I'll let you ask some questions if you want to know more along the way. For the listeners who aren't familiar, basically my claim to fame, you could say, started in January of 2020, 5 years ago now, nearly just 6 weeks shy. And I always remember that the context of this because my youngest daughter was, she was 6 weeks old at the time, and just celebrated her birthday last week. So we had a young family, young kids. I was involved in politics a bit. I was blogging for Right Minds NZ. I was working with the BFD, now Good Oil News, with Cameron Slater and so on. And it's a little bit interested in politics as well. I was a bit associated with the New Conservatives a little bit. And I wrote a lot criticizing the government, and especially the new Arms Act that had been brought in the previous year. I had made a submission against the new Arms Act. And in that submission, I said basically the Arms Act was, it had been hastily drafted and it was terrible legislation. They weren't giving any time for people to submit. They'd given 3 days submission before they passed the law hastily. And one of the things that I highlighted in the submission, and I copied this onto social media as well, was to say, hey, I've got a lever action rifle, like a cowboy gun from the 1800s that the cowboys would use, the gun that won the West. And it's got a tube magazine. It's got 15 rounds. It's 22 caliber, you know, little, In a sense, very small as far as firearms go. You could use it for plinking steel targets, maybe for rabbit hunting, although I think you'd struggle to hit a rabbit with it. And I said, hey, this gun will be caught up in this new legislation. It's got a tube magazine with 15 rounds. It'll have to be modified or destroyed or whatever. You know, it's basically becomes illegal if this legislation passes. And so the Arms Act is going to be completely broken, because they say that they're passing this new law because they want to ban military-style rifles. And this is clearly not a military-style rifle. And I made my complaints, and then I went on with my life. And then 6, 7, 8 months later, I get 12 armed police raiding my house at 6 p.m. Just come home from work. I came home early. My wife was not feeling well. She's, she was sick, looking after the baby. I was having dinner with the two older children, and get a knock on the door, and it's police with a warrant, armed, well armed, and they want to come into my house and have a look around, and they're looking for illegal firearms.
Well, so what was it? It was a 22, was it? So this is like a rabbit shooting gun.
Yeah, 22 caliber. So the smallest caliber you can get, like I said, lever action. But the main, the main thing was that the legislation changed magazine capacities. You could only have 10 rounds maximum in any firearm. So if you had a tube magazine, didn't matter what kind of firearm it was, you'd have to have it modified or have to get rid of it or do something with it. And of course, I had a bunch of options. I had like 5 or 6 different things I could have done with it. But of course, they basically, I was wondering, what are the police doing? And I found out later, they basically looked in their database. They had got an anonymous complaint from someone 6 months prior, a far left extremist who said, hey, there's this far right, hateful individual who has got this firearm, and I'm worried, he's very scary. And can you go and follow up on him and see if he's following the law? And please get back to me, but I'd like to remain anonymous. And this guy sent this into the police. And then obviously nothing happened. They didn't do anything. And then suddenly over Christmas, we got discovery during this court case and during Christmas time. Somebody was for some reason digging through their old emails and found this email and said, hey, you know, sent this back to the local arms office and said, hey, can you please investigate this person and see what's going on? And they did a whole investigation and they created a warrant of nearly 20 pages. And most of it was delving into my right-wing views. And they were saying how I was right-wing and that might mean that I would break the law because I was unhappy with the government. I was unhappy with the Arms Act. I was right-wing. And they said, we suspect that maybe he's not following the law. No actual evidence. Of course, I hadn't actually broken the law. I don't think I've really told people publicly what actually happened with the firearm, but it was actually very simple because I had a family holiday planned overseas. So I was overseas during the buyback, so I couldn't participate in the buyback. So I had legally had the firearm modified and handed off to someone else before I went overseas because I didn't want to have an illegal firearm potentially sitting in my house if I got stuck overseas. And I completely forgot about the whole situation until the police busted down my door.
I think you need to tell us, Steve, what it was like having 12 policemen come around to your house. Was this at nighttime?
Yes, it was 6 p.m. It was still light, but yeah, I mean,
what was that like, having 12 policemen come around your house? They were armed while you're having dinner with your family. Like, how did they explain what they were doing, and how did your family react to it? Like, what was it like inside the house while this was happening?
Yeah, I sort of almost went numb, went blank. I thought to myself, well, maybe this is some kind of setup. You know, what are they? Well, this is some kind of pretext. they're gonna make something up and get me, because they said, oh, you know, do you have this firearm? I said, well, obviously I don't have the firearm. Okay, can we?
You wonder if you were on candid camera or something, like, was this something?
And I didn't have a camera. I wasn't thinking straight. I didn't get my camera out. Like, I was just completely numb. Managed to get up the stairs. Told, and I tried to tell Amy, others, the police here. And she was sick as well, right? So she'd had a C-section as well. She was in bed, not able to get up, was looking after a six-week-old baby. And then I even forgot about my dinner. I found it an hour later, stone cold. I was like, oh, I've completely forgot to even finish my dinner. And they basically said, you know, you're being detained. You need to stay in this room, and we're going to go through the house. You know, they're going to go through the house. And so they just started rummaging through the house. They were professional in the sense that, you know, you can't complain. We couldn't get any complaints to say they had done the search improperly or that they had broken things or thrown everything out, you know, upside down. They left things in a tidy state, but they went through everything. They went through all of my stuff. They went through every single cupboard. They looked inside little jars. Like, for a moment I thought, are they looking for drugs or something? You know, they're like looking through the little jars on the tops of cupboards. And I thought, obviously you're not looking for a firearm.
They were looking for a firearm, but yes, they were looking through jars.
Yes, they're looking through jars and drawers and everything. Yeah,
it doesn't really.
I mean, I showed them my firearms, of course, right away. I said, well, here are my firearms, you can have a look at them. I can't remember what I had, but I had shotguns, you know, legal semi-automatic still, and large caliber hunting rifles and all kinds of stuff, you know, completely legal, of course. And they went through the whole house and said, where's the firearm? I said, you know, I said, I'm not saying anything, because I thought if I tell them anything, they're going to go and do this to someone else, because they, you know, I just was completely confused as to what's going on. Did call a lawyer who basically said as well, don't say anything, just remain silent. So I said, okay, I'm not saying anything. They tried to probe me a little bit to say something. No, I didn't say, which was quite scary too. I think trying to actually not say something when you feel like, oh, if I just say something, they'll go away. You know, you get that. I just say something and they'll go away. Thankfully, I was able to keep to this statement. I think I said about 20 or 30 words in total and didn't say anything else. Took them about an hour to go through the house. And then they sort of said, well, you know, you better comply, or maybe we'll, you know, we'll go and, you know, the fire, we can go and find the firearm somewhere else. Obviously, there's only a limited number of people maybe who are connected with you who might have it, and we'll go after them. Kind of vague threat at the end. So that was, you know, shaken by that a little bit as well. And yeah, that's quite, I don't want to use the word traumatic, but kind of traumatic, like a very disconcerting incident. Definitely my wife was very much traumatized by it. Just very just a terrible experience for her. I think that it's actually nice to finally, after 5 years, have some closure, to have the High Court rule on appeal to say the warrant was illegal or unlawful, whatever terminology you want to use. They got it under political pretext, essentially. They left out important context that they should have provided to the court to say, hey, this man is someone who is engaging in political speech and he's engaging in the democratic process. And they created this narrative basically to say, oh, he's right wing, so maybe he's breaking the law. Whereas they completely omitted the aspect of, I was someone who had said, you know, I'm going to follow the law, I'm following the law, they had no reason to believe I was breaking the law. But definitely for the whole family, it feels really good to finally have a solution, a resolution where what the police did was illegal. We can kind of put that behind us now to say, okay, I didn't do anything wrong. We didn't do anything wrong. The police were the ones who did something wrong.
I think people need to know. So the police raided your house. They came and they looked for a gun, and then they left you.
Yes.
Is that correct? And then after that, what happened after that? Did you pursue action?
Yeah, and I think there's some
wrongfully
confusion
raiding
sometimes, sometimes for people as well. They say, I didn't lose my firearms license. I didn't lose my firearms. They literally thought they would get a warrant, raided my house, and then just left me with firearms and ammunition and absolutely everything else. So they were hoping to get lucky, I guess. That was it. No, absolutely no reason, no actual reason to suspect that I had done anything wrong. And so after that, I went to the BFD, or Good Oil News, Cameron Slater, and I wrote an article and they published it. And so it went into the news here. It went into international news. We got like 100,000 clicks on the article in 48 hours. It was big news. And we got an outpouring of support from people who said, wow, this is outrageous. This should never have happened. And I give credit to the leaders of the opposition as well. David Seymour went on the media and said, this is outrageous. Simon Bridges at the time, he also went on the news and said, this shouldn't have happened. So very thankful to them for that. And then it sort of became, well, what do you do now? And this is where I think a lot of people would just leave it because it's too hard to do anything, too expensive to do anything. And I happen to have people who are involved with Right Minds, and some of these people are anonymous, still anonymous. So I won't say too much, but basically one of these guys said, hey, I can help you out. I can get a lawyer. I can set this up and we can do something. And had a bunch of different people as well come together and say, hey, we'll help with costs and things like that. So and it sort of kicked off from there. So we drafted up pleadings around the Bill of Rights, around trespass, and we filed the paperwork. And one of the reasons to file the paperwork too was I had done an OIA request, for instance, a Privacy Act request, to say, why did you raid my house? Can I have the warrant? Can I have all the information? And the police said they declined it on the basis of the fact that they were doing this was an active investigation. So they wouldn't give me the information, hadn't done anything wrong, hadn't charged me with anything, but they said, oh, we have an active investigation, so we can't give you any of these materials that you might need. So the only way for us to get those material, to find out why they did this and all of this behind the scenes emails and all of the other information, we had to take it to court to get discovery and then trust that they would actually give us all of the information, which we are not completely certain of, but at some point, you have no proof that the police are hiding something, then the courts say, well, you have to believe the police, and that's the end of that. So,
you took it to court,
yeah.
And under the discovery process, I think, I'm not a lawyer, but I imagine like they have to provide you with the documents you need as part of the legal case. That's what discovery means, I think.
Yes.
And so you got the information about why they raided your house, what the warrant was for and stuff. Can you run us through really specifically what the reasons were that they thought they needed to raid your house and what the legal justification they had for getting the warrant was?
The warrant, and I should try and actually should have had this in front of me when you were asking. I might quickly pull it up if I can. And the application of the warrant, as I said, so I've got it here now. Sorry, it's 32 pages long. Got it in front of me. Specifically said they were looking for a 22 lever action rifle, blued metal, brown wooden stock. They said they've added an annex about Facebook information and the Right Minds group. And so the beginning of the warrant here specifically lays out that I'm the editor-in-chief and founder of a group, a right-wing group, a right-wing political group. And they say that this is not by itself a suspicion of having firearms offended, but then they say this in the context of my posts about this particular firearm, that I had a high level of dissatisfaction with the amendment of the Arms Act, and that this level of dissatisfaction could possibly result in an intent to keep the prohibited firearm / magazine. So that was the gist of the reasoning.
So what's important to point out here, I think, is you have a political view, which is that the Arms Act is bad, and they're reading into that political view an intent to break the law. So they're assuming that. So this is kind of like a non-crime hate incident, although a little bit different. They're assuming there's something bad about what you're doing or an intent to break the law.
Yeah. Since now, I think one of the things they changed after this was to go to these non-crime hate incidents, because now they go and pay people visits instead of raiding their houses directly. So I think we got some slight change in the policy there, where they, at least I haven't heard of cases recently where they've gone directly to raid people's houses over political views. The first judge that we went to in the district court ignored this entire angle and just said, well, the police followed their processes, and so the police can do what they want, which is an insane argument in our opinion. So we appealed that, of course, and said, hey, this judge completely ignored the free speech angle. We need to revisit that. And thankfully, the judge of the High Court said, yeah, wow, this is pretty outrageous. And he basically said, as you know, what you've outlined here, said this, that police can't use someone's right-wing political views and then build up a case around that, especially when they're omitting the context that there's absolutely no reason why this person might actually break the law, because they've just said, obey the law. And so how can
the information, from what I understand, the information, at least some of it cited in the warrant, was you actually participating in the democratic process of submitting on the arms bill?
Correct. And one of the reasons why we won the case as well was that they cropped screenshot, and they excluded screenshots where that was explicitly clear. So they cropped material to kind of leave that bit off the warrant. So they included all this, they included the bits where I was participating in the democratic process, but the point where I actually said things like, please make a submission, they close in 24 hours, and linked off to the parliamentary select committee, they cropped that off in all of their material they gave to the court. However, like I said, it's 32 pages of material. I suspect as well that the court clerk who signed it off, because they also did something very sneaky, and that police are legally allowed to do. It's a loophole, because they can say, well, it's urgent to get a warrant. And so if the court is closed, if the judges have gone home for the day, we can go to court still and get the warrant signed off by a clerk, you know, not experienced as a judge. And they ran it past a court clerk because they took it after 5 p.m. for some reason, suddenly urgent after 5 p.m. when the judges had gone home. So we suspect, and again, we couldn't prove this, unfortunately. And the judge basically said, well, you can't prove this, so you can't, I can't give this to you. But that they were being a little bit malicious, I should say, that they kind of had it. They realized that this was of a dubious nature, and so they use some of the legal loopholes that the police have, some of the very shoddy work that they're allowed to do and that they can get away with, because it's very, very difficult to push back. Like, as I'm laying out here, it took me 5 years of trouble. It was extended because of COVID lockdowns. They shut down the courts and they stuffed up the whole court system for about 3 years when nothing happened. But yeah, the police can use these loopholes to kind of get these warrants and then just make it really, really difficult for people to go and get justice.
So you were targeted for your political views. And it wasn't even like you were doing something off in the secret. You were engaging in the political process at the parliament on a bill that submissions had been called for. Yeah. So what did the, in the final judgment that's just come out recently, what did that say? Did the judgment say that the police had engaged in sort of political persecution here?
Yes, again, I'll just bring up the outcome as well. And so the final outcome from the High Court here said, I find that the warrant process miscarried for failure to include a full copy of Mr. DeBoer's post. They cropped it. And in particular, the part providing a link to the select committee process, given the emphasis placed on Mr. DeBoer's participation in a quote-unquote right-wing group by the police, this failure to render the link meant the judicial officer was left with an unfair impression of Mr. DeBoer, one that might support an inference that he would unlawfully retain possession of the rifle shown in the post. But the reference to the link supports an altogether more cognate inference, namely that Mr. DeBoer was seeking engagement in the democratic process. Given this, the application was flawed, and I consider that a judge properly appraised of the facts would likely decline the application, given there being no information that I posed any sort of risk and so on. So we won on exactly on that basis. And then, I'm trying to find the judgment again, 28 pages here. I haven't got the paragraph in front of me.
But what's interesting about this comes, I mean, this happened a long time before the recent visits of Nob Oddy, who've you've interviewed. But that's a similar sort of thing, isn't it?
Exactly.
They're using, I mean, he's more the non-crime hate incident, which is a sort of newer thing. But they're going after him and they're threatening to take away his firearms license. They have taken away his firearms license.
He has it back now. So in his case, with a little bit of help, he came to me and a few other people, Cam Slater as well, and the Free Speech Union, lots of different people pitched in to help out there. So we're getting good at kind of pushing back against the police on this. But yeah, they don't take in a hint very easily, apparently.
And this is the same thing that's happening in the UK, and it's happening in a lot of other places as well. We're seeing, you know, governments, police forces, intelligence agencies, various government departments using conservative views or right-wing views of various types, and they're conflating that with criminal intent or hate or terrorism or violence, and then using that as a pretext to do things they really shouldn't be doing, like coming and raiding people's houses or spying on them, or intimidating them, engaging in intimidating sort of behavior or harassing people in various ways. And there's a lot of people out there who don't appreciate that this is going on. This is really a form of ideological bias against conservative and right-wing people that's coming from the state and all sorts of Western governments around the world, including our own. And when people like you and people like me are sort of grumpy about wokeness, this is a big part of what we're going on about, isn't it? Like, it's not just something we disagree with. It's something that is unfairly targeting and harassing us, and it's treating us unfairly. Is that your feeling about it?
Oh, absolutely the case. And it's very clear, too, that the police actively collude with these woke groups, left-wing extremists, far-left extremists, and basically just allow themselves to become political tools. You could say that it's a mistake, or they do so without really thinking it through, but it wouldn't make any difference if they were doing it deliberately or not. The fact is, they are doing it. If you look at the material, the claims that were made against me, it was pretty obvious that this person had a political axe to grind and was asking the police to do his dirty work.
Yeah, and so this is a sort of, we've talked about institutional bias a lot, how there's a sort of institutional bias in favor of woke stuff and against conservative stuff. And this is a sort of another example of it. And you have to wonder whether, like, there's just so much of the left-wing woke stuff going around sort of established in these institutions. I mean, I'm unsure whether they really, I think they know what they're doing is bad sometimes, but sometimes they don't. Sometimes they're stewing in this sort of ideology that they don't realize that what they're doing is wrong and unfair and persecuting people based on their political views. Do you agree with that?
And I can add, in this particular context of this particular Arms Act, the police had pushed for this as well. Like, this was this was endorsed by the police, it was their legislation. Obviously, they had stuffed up pretty badly in 2019 with the Christchurch terror attack, where they had given a firearms license to a terrorist and they hadn't done their jobs properly. And then they did the whole buyback, which, I mean, I wrote about the week before they raided me, I wrote an article saying the buyback was a complete failure. And I did a statistical analysis showing that based on, purchased out of firearms, something like 13% to 18% of firearms had been destroyed, being chased down and destroyed by the police, whatever the context of that was. And so basically said, oh, they completely failed at this. And at the time it felt like hey, they're punishing me for pointing out the facts that they've completely stuffed up again. And then of course they went after me, which was also another stuff up for them, and I don't think they were expecting things to go badly for them. And in a large part, though, it went badly for them because I had people who were willing to step out for me. I had friends and I'd been politically active. This is something that easily, if it had happened to other people, because sometimes I hear that something similar sort of happens to people and they aren't interested in going public with it for whatever reason. They don't want to take it any further, or they just want to be left alone, and people don't hear about it. And so, I've been very, very fortunate to have a lot of people who are willing to support me on this.
But you mean you've won and you've been vindicated. So I think that's really important. But how do you feel for having gone through all this and getting the victory? Has it changed the way you think about politics, about society, about the culture we're living in, about government?
I would say my politics has changed a lot in the last 5 years, in part because of this. Actually, my wife's just saying to me last night, I thought, we had got the news that we had won, and we're celebrating and talking about reminiscing on certain aspects. And she had said, they could have just left you alone, basically, and instead they've sort of created an enemy. And now I'm very motivated to go after them and to make changes. And, I realize just how important it is to control these institutions and to have, to have access to power. Otherwise, you just get completely annihilated. So I think I was a little bit more naive before. And now I have a very concrete understanding of how power and politics works, because I've actually experienced it. I've experienced what the legal system is like. It's tough to call it a justice system, but every now and then it comes through, but very, very difficult to work with. And then you start to understand maybe why things are the way that they are. Yeah, I think very much more so motivated as well to make sure that these people who went after me, these far left extremists, to make sure that they can't harm anybody else again. I want to make sure that they can't do this to anyone else again. So I'm very, very motivated to make sure that they are defeated one way or another.
Well, well done. I'm happy that you've been vindicated, and that the police who have unfairly raided you have been embarrassed. I think that's just.
Yeah, and I hope there's some kind of reflection and change, because there have been a few political cases, even left-wing ones in the last few years, where the police have raided people. People may remember the Nikki Haga case was actually one of the cases that we referenced. There are other cases in the United States, Canada, and the UK that we referenced as well, because there hasn't been a case in this particular, with the exact same facets that my case had in New Zealand. So we sort of got a new bit of case law around the Bill of Rights and how it applies to engaging in the democratic process with free speech, particularly right-wing speech in this case. I hope that provides a lot more protection for people engaging in politics in the future in New Zealand, so that if the police come into a different situation, they remember, oh yes, there's that case that we lost. We can't, we need to think about this a little bit harder. So I'm hoping there's some actual changes behind the scenes at the police because of that. And we will be pushing for that a little bit more. I'm going to meet at some point in the future. It's coming up to the end of the year, so maybe early next year, I'm going to try and get a meeting with the police minister or some of the associate police ministers and see, hey, is something going to change at the police, because this shouldn't be happening. And there's a few other people like Nob Oddy who we discussed, Gareth, and go with him as well and say, hey, five years, the police are still doing similar stuff. They've just changed tactics. We need to make sure that we stamp this out and then get a commitment from these politicians to stamp it out. And otherwise, we need to start looking at, what do we do in the next election? What kind of policy potentially could fix this and so on? What kind of institutional changes need to be made at the police? Yeah, I think it is difficult. Part of it is personnel as well. How do you get good people into the police now that they are acting in this way and have been so ideologically captured? So difficult things to solve over the long run.
Do you have ideas of what sort of legal or institutional changes are needed? Or?
At the moment, not yet. I haven't gone that far. My mental focus has been very much on the court case, the legal aspect. I have not had very much time to devote to what happens after. So that I'll do that over the next few months, and we'll see if we can come up with something good.
Yeah, good.
So for me, this is not just this is the end of this particular chapter, this particular saga, but I'm very, very motivated to carry on. And like I said, one of the reasons I took the cases was, okay, I want to make sure that this doesn't happen to somebody else. This should be illegal, and it is now found to be illegal. So that's the start. And we want to make sure that's definitely going to be the case in practice.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, thank you very much for your questions, and I do hope I've given a good explanation to the listeners. It's I realized we were talking just before the show that you hadn't really been following this because you and I have only been in touch in the last year or so, and this has been going on for 5 years. So there are a lot of people involved at RCR, or people who are listening to RCR, people who are involved in politics elsewhere, who have come onto the scene in the last few years and are only vaguely familiar with this case. So yeah, it's good to be able to explain it again to people, and I'm more than willing to go into it in more detail with others. I know there's a few people who want to go into this with me with more detail. There may be some more podcasts and other interviews that I will do because there's just so much material here. I've got hundreds and hundreds of pages of discovery documents and court judgments, and on it goes. So it's the many, many different aspects to this case. Now we will carry on a little bit and go over a few other items from the past week, because obviously that item was very, very important to me personally, but a few other things have happened in New Zealand politics. And I would also like to go over big things that you think the government has achieved in the last year, and then maybe some of your own personal highlights as well. So one of the international bits of news that we had last week, which does relate to a legal case, so we may as well talk about that now, is that the Prime Minister, Christopher Luxon, has said that the International Court's criminal court's arrest warrant of Benjamin Netanyahu would be enforced if he stepped foot in New Zealand. This has obviously caused a little bit of an uproar. People in favor, people against it. What are your views on international law here and the International Criminal Court as it applies to New Zealand, and basically requiring us to declare war on Israel if their prime minister or former defense minister actually turn up in the country? Because I think that would be interpreted as as an act of war.
Well, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Like, what is the status of sort of international law and the International Criminal Court, you know? And what are the limits of international law, and what counts as sort of diplomacy, sort of realist diplomacy, versus obligations to international law? And I think, you know, that's why we've got sort of divided views over this. There's a lot of people who are pro-Israel who think that this is, you know, silly, and that Luxon's, you know, has put his foot in it and embarrassed himself, or, you know, like he's doing something borderline anti-Semitic by saying he'd arrest Netanyahu if he came here. And there's other people who have a more, you know, a commitment to international law, who think the ICC is on the up and up, subscribe to more of the liberal internationalist view that says we have to uphold international laws, international norms, and the decisions of international institutions, who think that that would be totally appropriate to sort of arrest the guy and ship him away. I don't know where you would send him. Do you send him to The Hague or something like that? Or,
Yes, well, officially, he would go to The Hague, and apparently the United States has a special clause in one of their laws that states that if a United States or Israeli politician is ever arrested at The Hague, that the United States would actually invade The Hague and destroy it. So that would probably end in a bit of a disaster if it did happen, which is why it's not going to happen, of course.
yeah. Well, it's interesting though, because Israel is sort of in the sort of countries that Israel is attacking or waging war on now, in Gaza and in Lebanon and in other places, there are sort of UN staff who are being occasionally killed, or UN bases and buildings and stuff that are occasionally being blown up. UNRWA, United Nations, UNRWA, I can't remember off the top of my head now exactly what that stands for, but it's something about the managing what's going on in the Gaza, UN aid agency in Gaza. Israel is engaged in a propaganda war against UNRWA. I mean, they would argue that UNRWA is doing that back to them as well. That they're basically viewing those two entities, Israel and UNRWA, are viewing each other as like enemy combatants and engaged in a sort of propaganda war, a war of words against each other. And as sort of the US is on the side of Israel in this conflict, you're really getting Israel, and then kind of the US, and then kind of you know, pro-Israeli people, countries, and factions around the world lining up against the United Nations. And it's sort of it's not really good for international law and international institutions. some people will think that that's a good thing. These institutions, these globalist institutions, I guess you could call them, are no good, and you know, they're trying to get more global control, which I think there's a bit of truth to, and it's good to delegitimize them. But the other view is that, which I'm also sympathetic to, so I'm on the fence on this question, is that you know, there's a place for international law and international norms and, you know, institutions like the UN to facilitate cooperation between countries, because there is things that countries need to cooperate on. And there is a place for structures to facilitate that cooperation. And so to the extent that those institutions are doing that, it might be a negative thing for them to be delegitimized in this way. So, I mean, that's what I see the significance of this incident as being.
There's an interesting thread here that I think goes through a lot of the stories that we talked about in the past year on RCR around neutrality of institutions and state neutrality in general. And so it's that case of these international institutions that there's some kind of expectation that they're neutral, or the people treat them as if that they are neutral. But there's a really a broader discussion that needs to be had and that is being had, which is that, is there such a thing as neutrality in these agencies? And you just spoke about this with the New Zealand police as well. And people say, well, the New Zealand police are neutral. The New Zealand police need to be neutral. And as we find out that in reality, there's no neutrality there. And this has also led to recent debates from some of these centrists, these liberal centrists, who are saying or accusing some people on the right wing of being the quote unquote woke right. Come up with this idea to say that the woke right are the people who want to have more right-wing control of institutions and basically do the opposite of the left, which is why they use this word woke. So, well, it's they're the opposite of the woke, so we'll call them the woke right. But of course, it's a little bit absurd to call people who are the complete opposite to actually be the thing that you're accusing them of. It's the same thing if you had, say, a revolutionary and a counter-revolutionary. Would you say, well, you know what, the counter-revolutionary is actually a revolutionary because he's the opposite of the revolutionary? So it's a bit of an absurd way to come up with the name. But the reason that they've come up with this idea of the quote-unquote woke right is because the people on the right, myself included, increasingly are rejecting this idea that, hey, there's state neutrality and there's this idea that somehow everything can be equal, that many of these liberals still have. They say, well, if only everything was equal, if only everything was neutral, then suddenly things would be right again. I simply don't think that's a helpful way to look at the world, because it's not true. I've personally experienced this not being true.
Yeah, liberalism as an ideology has this self-conception of itself as being like a value neutral and as a procedural means of working out disagreements between different nations in terms of you know international institutions like the UN, or different groups in society, or different ideologies in the case of and liberal democratic forms of governance. Liberalism is viewing itself here as a procedural means of sorting out disagreements and conflicts between groups, nations, peoples, ideologies in a non-violent way. And I guess the philosophical debate here is whether that sort of neutrality is really possible, or whether liberalism is sort of self-deluded in a way, and that it views itself as being neutral while really making value judgments in terms of the positions it takes. And I think I lean towards the latter. It's really sort of self-deluded. For example, if you take the education system, there is a curriculum. Children are taught things, and the things that they are taught have value judgments within them, at the very least implicitly. Decisions have to be made about what those value judgments that inform those things are. Or maybe the decisions don't have to be made, but the value judgments will be there, because education is something that can't be done in a neutral way. There has to be the things that you choose to teach them, and the way you teach them, and the perspective you teach them from, it's shot through with all sorts of value judgments, and those will be informed by an ideological perspective. And it's not just the education system, it's all sorts of things. The government is involved in media. It's involved in academia, the production of knowledge. It's the way the laws work. Anytime you're dealing with public policy necessarily involves value judgments being made, and you can never reduce it merely to a sort of procedural means of determining outcomes. And what we've seen, like over the past, well, and some people have different sort of starting points for this, but as we've gone along, we've seen these sort of the liberal freedoms and liberal neutrality have the effect of eroding sense of shared culture, shared moral norms, any sort of religion, and any shared idea of the common good. And many people think, and I'm inclined to agree, that this is that liberal democratic institutions and forms of government necessarily have this sort of eroding effect on those shared things that are necessary to hold society together. And so that's a real problem, because it means over time that the people in society have less in common. They find themselves, you know, blasting apart in all directions over the moral map, to coin a phrase. And because you have to live with them, because there will be some sort of moral view that informs the laws and legislation, it means that you have to compromise more and more things so that the actual rights that you have are less. And we see these sort of conflicts over basic rights arise all the time. So you can't have traditional marriage and gay marriage. You know, both the traditionalists and the gay people can't have both have their way at the same time on that one. Someone's basic views are going to be demeaned. And there's many other cases like this. Abortion rights, for example. Abortion is treated as if it's a sacred thing by many feminists, but a life is sacred, obviously, to many conservative people, religious people, and other people. And so if you have to compromise on that question, someone necessarily doesn't get their way. And so this fact that when we have more different groups with more different value judgments operating within the liberal system means you have to make more compromises. It means that liberalism isn't really fulfilling its role as an adjudicator between these competing groups. It's meaning what's happening is our rights and our shared conception of the common good is eroding over time, making all of us worse off. And I think that the real way to solve this problem is something that you and I have discussed elsewhere, and that's to allow different groups not to have their own sort of political autonomy, rather than to share spaces and institutions with others where they have to compromise their rights and compromise the way things are run with these other groups.
And then the situation you're describing often is referred to as parallelism by people, or parallel institutions. And some countries have implemented this to an extent one way or another. And of course, it will look different depending on the context of people who are living and whether or not they can remain in harmony. We can really see this conflict in that you've been describing in New Zealand's political system, because you see, especially those who are the most dedicated to liberalism in New Zealand, like the National Party officially, is the most dedicated to liberalism. And they claim sort of neutrality on a lot of these issues that you've outlined, right? And it means that it becomes very hard to actually have a sane functioning country when, for instance, the puberty blockers being a big item of discussion, transgenderism, mutilation of children is what it is. And then you have these liberals who are trying to say, well, you know, maybe we let people decide what they want. We'll let parents decide if they want to mutilate their children and so on. And they turn this, again, as you say, into this idea, they try to act like they're neutral, like there's some kind of neutral position that they can hold where everybody gets their way. But of course, this is completely insane. And it's really holding us back. It's really preventing us from making any meaningful advances in our attempt to return things back to a sane state. And it's like this with the Treaty Principles Bill that we've discussed over the past few months. It's been a hot topic this year. Again, they're playing sort of the middle ground, not wanting to make any particular commitment. And instead, you, of course, then what do you get? You get increasing radicalization on either side. And at some point, the system continues to lean more so in one direction, and it's always the left-wing direction that they end up leaning. Naturally, liberalism decays into progressivism.
Yeah, well, David Seymour is, there's a lot of good things I like about the Treaty Principles Bill. So I'll just say that at the beginning, because now I'm going to kind of bag it a little bit. David Seymour's campaigning on equal rights, right? So equal rights. But the communists are for equality, right? And what happens with communism in practice is that you're only really able ever to equalize downwards by, in the case of communism, making wealthy people poorer. And the rights debate, the equal rights debate, is a lot like that. The only way in practice we're going to be able to make people have equal rights is by taking the indigenous rights, the different rights that Maori have, off them.
Yeah, and there's no discussion about giving extra rights to everyone else, right? There's no leveling up of the rights, so to speak. But
is that really an improvement?
Well, everyone needs to decay. Everyone's sense of identity needs to be leveled out. And so the amount of tradition you're allowed to have, the amount of ethnic particularity that you're allowed to have, that has to be pulled down to the same level. And of course, this seems to their main result there becomes what the progressive has, is complete atomization, where everything is broken down to the level of the individual, and the individual decides exactly what he or she wants to do, which is where we get to, of course, the whole transgenderism debate that's going on. And we have, of course, euthanasia, assisted suicides, and all of these things start to come down to this level of purely the individual. And then there's no way for people to build families, to build nations, because these are collective ideas. So the entire concept of people having a collective identity has to be destroyed. And then, well, you don't have a nation anymore. And that's kind of, as you explained, that's sort of the natural end progression of talking about, okay, we need to level everybody out to be treated equally.
Yeah, people's behavior is shaped by the cultural and the moral norms and the society around them. Most of the things you do are things you don't really actively and consciously choose to do. As you're growing up, you sort of naturally start behaving in the way the people around you are behaving without sort of, you know, doing like cost benefit calculations or things like that. And it's only as you sort of get older and start interrogating some of these ways that you behave that you evaluate them and that you change them. So the effect of this sort of thing making everyone into an individual and saying you have to choose is you take these moral and cultural guardrails away, and it can harm people, because people, you know, the amount of things that you do, you're not capable really of making like choices about all these things. You need the cultural guardrails in place to sort of guide you to a healthy and good behavior. And this is especially true as you move down the socioeconomic ladder. You know, there may be like, you know, that the top 0.05% or whatever is capable of making all these decisions on a sort of fully self-conscious way. But most people aren't like that. They're just going to pick up the behaviors from the culture around them. And if you destroy those cultural norms through this process, they're going to be impoverished. And that's basically what we've done, what has occurred in Western societies over the previous decades.
Mm. And then it's easy to say, oh, well, they've made those decisions. People have made their individual decisions. But in reality, many of these people are not acting consciously as individuals in any meaningful way. And as you said, because you've taken away their sort of default behavior, in that sense, most people just live on autopilot. You know, not to be disparaging, I don't mean that in a negative way. It's actually sort of a good thing for most people. They're not really actively thinking about all of those different decisions. And
I think the individualists, I'll just interrupt you, like the idea of individualism, that people are these rational and self-interested people that make decisions about their lives and choose how they turn out as a sort of conscious thing. That idea of what a person is just a false idea, I think. Most of the things that make you the way you are the things that you don't choose, that it's your genes, it's who your parents were, the language you speak, the culture you grew up in, what religion was in the home, what school you went to. You don't choose any of those things. And those are the things that really do the bulk of the work in shaping who you are. And even when it comes to the choices you make for yourself, all those things go into shaping the choices that you make. So, you know, like this idea that individuals are choosing the way they turn out and that they're totally culpable and responsible for the way they turn out is not accurate, I don't think. Your culture chooses you more than you choose your culture, I think.
And in the end, what do we see with all of this? Everything that's happened is that there's actually an increasing radicalization towards people looking for some kind of identity. So you get this, all the speaking of identity politics, gender identity, Maori nationalism. Like Maori nationalism is a very modern thing and it's growing very, very rapidly in a large part because people end up rejecting this in a very extreme way.
People can sense on some level that there's something wrong and there's something missing, and they're intuitively grasping that this is the thing that's missing and we need to go back and have more of this. I don't think most of the people who are acting this way can articulate it. Even I struggle to articulate it. But I think intuitively there's a grasp that that's the missing thing and that's what we need to do.
All right. Well, I think that this will remain a very important topic into the coming years and next year as well. And it has been a very common theme in the last year. So I hope that all of the listeners were able to follow those arguments a little bit. I think we got quite theoretical there, but a lot of the issues that we have been talking about on the weekly roundup in the last year have touched on that. And I think it's very, very important to maybe just spend a little bit more time as we have digging into the philosophical underpinnings of some of that. And as you say, sometimes it is difficult to articulate. It can just be difficult to articulate. Like, oh, that feels like the right thing. And yeah, obviously, a lot of this touches on things that the coalition government has been working on. So I'm very, very quickly at the end here going to ask you, how do you think that the coalition government has performed in its first year? They've spent a proper full year in office. Are you happy with what they're doing? Do you believe that they're headed for success? They've got two more years to go. Are they achieving a lot of the things that they wanted to achieve and things that you want them to achieve?
Well, they're sort of making some moves in the right direction, but nothing's really going far enough or fast enough. So I'll start with immigration. And the thing about immigration is like this is what I think is the most important issue, but it wasn't something that was campaigned on very strongly in this election. However, the rates of immigration coming into New Zealand are still very high. They have been coming down, but they still haven't been coming down quickly or fast enough for my liking. So things are still getting worse on that front, as far as I'm concerned. On some of the other stuff, so I think this promising stuff happening in the treaty principles sort of space, I think you might not agree with everything that the treaty principles bill does, but I think it's good to have a national conversation about it. A lot of people are worried that that's divisive, but I think it's good and healthy in a democracy that we would talk about that. And there is the deletion of the treaty principles and legislation that Winston Peters and New Zealand First snuck into the coalition agreement. And I'm assured that all that is going well and that's going to happen. So that's good. A lot of these other things, that the transgender bathrooms thing, you would have thought that that would be a fairly easy thing to do, the transgender bathrooms and the transgender people in women's sport, that they could have just, as soon as they got in, they could have just said, right, review the guidelines. But there's all these, it doesn't seem as if they've fully got there on that stuff, that they're sort of dithering and they're taking a long time and it's hard to get there. So it's sort of a little bit disappointing. In terms of the general economic picture, the Nicola Willis's first budget had a very large deficit. So
my low lights there. It was just completely disastrous.
Yeah. And I saw a tweet from Eric Crampton recently that the government revenues are running below the forecasts and government spending is running above the forecasts. And so the forecast deficit in the budget, in Nicola Willis's first budget, was already very high, but it's running even worse than the forecasts. So there's still a lot of work to do, even on the basic economic stuff that you would normally trust a national government to do well. They haven't even really been that fiscally responsible, I guess you would say. So that's, yeah. There's more areas I'm missing here.
If you extend this out to, say, deregulation as well, right? David Seymour promised deregulation. What have we seen, like, actually in a year?
There's been some good stuff on the farm rules, I think. Like, the agricultural farm rules, people like Andrew Hoggard and Todd McClay, the Minister of Agriculture, they've taken agriculture out of the ETS in 2025. Many of these farm rules, so that this is things like the SENAs, the farm plans, the rules around water and nutrients leaching into water on farms. They've paused a lot of that stuff or rolled it back, and they've rolled a lot of it into the RMA legislation and reforms that they're doing. So they've gotten rid of a lot of that stuff. And Christopher Luxon's just been on a big tour with Federated Farmers that, I forget what he calls it, but like a farm confidence, bringing farm confidence back tour. And so I think they've done some good work in that area. But the regulations in general, this was David Seymour's big promise. He was going to build a big new regulation cutting ministry, and then they were going to go through all the regulations and start taking them out. So I'm not sure much has really happened in that space, has it? Unless I've been sort of missing it.
No, and we especially, you have something to compare it to now. You've got Malay and Argentina. You're obviously going to have next year Elon Musk with Doge in America. He's got some real competition, and he's looking very unserious compared to the international competition when it comes to cutting regulation. So I'd put that as something that needs a lot more work. One positive one, I guess, that is worth mentioning as well, that National campaigned on was law and order. They seem to have made some dent in, after having spent the first half of the show bagging the police, they seem to have made a dent in the gangs. They promised to go hard against gangs. They're going hard against gangs, right? So, election promise made, election promise fulfilled. Whatever you think about the details, whether or not you approve of the gang patch ban and so on, at some level, they are following through on what they promised they would do, and it seems to be working.
Yeah, I think the statistics come out, or Mark Mitchell put out a press release saying that violent crime was down, I forget the number off the top of my head, but a significant amount, especially like I think things like ram raids and youth break-ins and things like that are down. So that's all very positive.
And I will need to review the coalition tracker that I've got. It's been a while, been very, very busy, but I'm going to do a proper review before the end of the year. So expect to see that before Christmas. I'll see if it can be included in the bites, if those are still going by then. And I'll give you some statistics on exactly what percentage of the coalition commitments they have achieved, because they should be about a third of the way through. And I suspect that they are going to be a little bit short when I'm done reviewing that. But of course, I'll continue tracking over the next few years. Well, I think that's about it. That's the weekly roundup done for today and for this year. Thank you very much. It's, from the very first show, from the very first dialogue show, you were there, William, and here you are at the end of the year, still there. So what a year it's been. I would rate, an eventful year, I would rate this year very, very highly. And I think we have come a very long way, both the show, the dialogue here, RCR in general, and I think the country, and even globally, the entire discourse on many of the subjects that keep coming up on the show. Things have moved in a very, very positive direction, one that's more friendly to the views that we hold.
Yeah, thanks, Theo. It's a great pleasure to do these shows. I mean, I love coming on every week and talking about the issues and talking to you about them as well. It helps me think things through, and it's good to communicate with the RCR audience and see the feedback come in. So great stuff, and I look forward to doing it again in the new year.
Well, that is it, everyone. It has been a pleasure to be hosting this show. It's been a pleasure to be a part of Reality Check Radio, and I really look forward to next year. And until then, I'm signing off for the last time in 2024, and we'll see you all again in 2025. Goodbye.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.